Glenn Greenwald, and why privacy matters. Let's begin episode. It's the Mess in Mesopotamia. It's the Mess in Mesopotamia edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, racism and health, lies in history of Iraq, and some web wisdom, Glenn Greenwald, and why privacy matters. Let's begin episode 275.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. And we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is a re-rant about the confluence of racism history and quack medicine. In a recent court decision, a little girl has been given a death sentence, and I believe because she's Native. I can't understand how such a thing can happen. Well, that's a lie. I guess I can understand how it can happen. I just don't understand why it still happens. Why the one place where justice is supposed to provide a guiding light has itself been swayed by political correctness. What is the sentence? Well, to die from leukemia. How? By not forcing her into treatment against her and her parents' wishes. The child in question is in a situation because, as a minor, McMaster's Children's Hospital pressed the case that by refusing treatment, the parents are endangering the child's life. The court ruled that she could pursue other treatments. Let me get this straight. A little girl is going to die because she's Native. And the court thinks that she should be treated less than you or I. Leukemia used to be a death sentence, but now most forms have a greater than 90% recovery, thanks to real medicine. Instead of proper proven treatment, the legal system of Canada is going to let this girl die in the hands of a quack in Florida. It's called alternative medicine not because it's an alternative form of medicine, but because it's alternative to medical treatment. It's like we went back 200 years, and it's disgusting. I don't blame the parents. I mean, they're too close to the issue to really have an objective view. And I can't blame the child. I mean, they're a child. What the hell do they know? And I applaud the Hamilton Hospital for trying to save this child's life. But I'm disgusted at a legal system that treats Natives as different, as if their life is less important because of other issues. If this were a white child, is there any doubt that they would have sided on the side of saving the poor kid's life? I think not. In a racist context, this rule is laid out by many of the Native leaders' reactions to this case. Okay, now maybe first I should explain why I'm calling this racist, as opposed to cultural sensitivity, historical justice, or even Native self-rule. Leukemia is a medical condition. It's not a philosophy. It's not a way of life. It's not some choice. You get leukemia irrespective of your ethnicity. As a medical condition, the treatment is also medical, and it's also independent of where you happen to have been born from. That is, leukemia is one of the best understood cancers. After decades of testing and studying, we've developed treatments that are as good as 95% success rate, where previously you had a 5% success rate. Now I say we, I would have thought it would meant that any rational human, but no, the court seems to think that we mean white man's medicine. You know, maybe I should stop here. Every time I try and address this issue, I just get so very angry, so very upset, so frustrated. And okay, I know there's a historical context of racism in residential schools. The judge hearing the case concluded in his rules that traditional Aboriginal treatments were in existence before First Nation communities were in contact with Europeans and were consequently entitled to special protection in Canada. What the hell does that mean? It's not, at least in this case, it's not even feckin' Native. The child in question is being worked over by a quack in Florida who claims to be a doctor and it's not recognized by one, using woo treatments. And this is racist. As I mentioned before, a similar case arose over blood transfusions. And in that case, the Supreme Court of Canada placed the health interests of the child above any magical thinking, be that of the child or the parent. But in this case, she's a Native child. Well, your health is less important than a white child. In this case, race was the most important factor and the one that should have nothing to do with healthcare. Again, I'm going to have to stop and just go for a break. This is such a fecked up rule, and it's I'm disgusted with the court system. With any system that thinks raw veggies can cure cancer as opposed to real medicine. I mean, let's just feck it. We'll be right back after this break.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
And we're back. Okay, today we're going to do a little bit of a history lesson. A loyal listener to Radio Freethinker asked me if it was true that the U.S. sold weapons of mass destruction, or WMDs, to Iraq, and that it was because Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, possibly including nuclear ones, well, this was the justification for the Iraq War, or the Second Gulf War. They then asked if it was true that the U.S. did not actually find any WMDs in Iraq, that the U.S. government knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, and the whole basis for the war was fraudulent, based on lies. They then asked why was everyone so upset with Bill Clinton getting a blowjob, but no one seemed enraged about Bush lying his way into the Iraq War. Well, there is sort of a lot there, and some of it kind of contradictory. So I thought I would do a little of sort of everything you need to know about Iraq. And warning, this will make you a little angry and probably a little depressed. Let's explore the whole history of Iraq and how that contributes to today's current quagmire. So let's start at the beginning. And don't worry, we'll be using a sort of wide brush to start with and become more focused as we approach our current time, so no one should fall asleep. In the beginning there was man, and he was good. Of course, there was also women, and she was equally as good. Well, as these people began to settle down, homes evolved into states and families into civilizations. This was first achieved, evolved, in Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is the land between the two rivers. That's the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, modern-day Iraq, plus or minus a few bits. I say first, but to be fair, like in biology, sociology seems to have a sort of a convergence evolution. That is, the same trait evolves independently in different parts of the world. So civilization evolved around 6500 BC, or almost 9,000 years ago, in the Sumerian city-states of Mesopotamia, but also evolved along the Nile around the same time, as well as in the Indus cultures dating back to about 3000 BC, and China makes the claim for the first of its dynasties around 2000 BC. This is not to say that there were not people living together in large groups, but this is where we sort of slip from prehistoric to historic history. That is, historians correlate sort of the birth of civilization with the ability to write about it. This is why in the Americas, their civilization seems to have evolved relatively recently, about 1000 BC. And that's not because there are no evidence for complex society. For example, there were buildings in Peru dating back to 3500 BC. It's just that they didn't like to talk about themselves and thus are sort of placed in that secondary class of cultural evolution. But I digress. So after the Sumerians, Iraq was the center of many famous civilizations, notably the Babylonians and the Assyrian Empire. It's the birthplace of law. Think of Hammurabi's Code. And then you have the epics of Gilgamesh, set and written in the earliest part of Iraq, if I may use that term in this context. Many scholars believe the Epic of Gilgamesh, written around 28 BC, are the roots of the Abrahamic faith, which didn't get their start until 1,000 years later. When Iraqi thinks of its history, they can go back almost farther back than anyone else and know that the influence they have had on the evolution of Western civilization is extreme. That said, the independent glory of Iraq was lost for many hundreds of years and only really returned with the invasion of the Mohammedans. It was under Islamic rule that Baghdad, in particular, entered a second golden age as sort of the brains of the Islamic world, being the center place for literature, science, and academia. This golden age came to a crashing end with the sacking of Baghdad by the Mongols. Ever since, this piece of land has found itself sort of the chew toy fought over between the rulers of Persia and the Ottomans. I'm going to stop here and point out that not all Muslims are the same, and that Iraq, being a focal point of civilization, has a complex religious and ethnic makeup. Now, some of us may be old enough to remember this song. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yeah, we wept when we remembered Zion. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yeah, we wept when we remembered Zion. And the wicked carried us away in captivity, required from us the song. Now how shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? This is significant because Abraham, the inventor of Judaism, of course, Judaism evolved into Christianity, which in turn mutated into Islam. Well, so all of these religions are referred to as sort of the Abrahamic religion because they all trace back their roots to Abraham. So anyhow, Abraham left Ur. Ur was a city-state and sort of the forerunner of Babylon. He then went on to Canaan and founded both the Jewish faith and the nation of Israel. Now, I did say this was pre-Babylon. But the song, it goes, by the rivers of Babylon. It's making reference to Babylon. Well, this is a reference to the first diaspora of Jews who were taken away from what we would call Israel and taken to Babylon, largely as slaves, or something like that. I mean, it's all based on the Bible, which is all basically fiction. But the point being that there is, well, was, I think today, a small but historically deep Jewish population in Iraq. Of course, adding to this is the spread of Christianity at the spear point of the Romans. In particular, Assyria became a major center for Christian faith. Then, of course, you have the major sectarian cleavage, which is between the Sunnis and the Shiites. Islam actually has many sects, much like Christianity. You know, you think Southern Baptist, Unitarians, Anglicans, Quakers, you kind of get the idea. That said, in Christianity, there is sort of one major dividing line. That's between the Catholics and the Protestants. Well, although effectively the same thing, but of course completely different, you find a similar major divide in Islam, ergo the Sunni-Shiite split. The technical reason for the split was a disagreement over who was the rightful successor to Muhammad. The Sunnis backed Abu Bakr, the father of Muhammad's wife, while the Shiites thought that Muhammad divinely ordained his cousin and son-in-law Ali. That said, there are some theological differences. The Sunnis believe in the five pillars of Islam. Think of this as sort of the equivalent to the traditional Catholic or Latin Bible. Now, the Shiites accept this, but they also have the, quote, roots of religion and the branches of religion as also foundational to their text. If I'm going to keep my parallels with Christianity sort of together, one might think of this as sort of the difference between the Latin Bible versus the King James Bible. Although, take with it as you can. So I'm going to sort of skip the details, and the point being is that you have two extremely similar, at least to outsiders, faiths. Well, those who practice said faith see the differences as stark as night and day. This sectarianism is one of the major sources of conflict in the region. That said, these tensions have been more or less balanced and controlled by strong, often foreign, rulers. The modern history of Iraq begins with it gaining its independence from the Ottomans at the end of World War I, only to find themselves a, quote, protectorate of the British Empire. It was under this rule that the tried and true practice of colonial Britain, that of elevating a minority to rule a majority, making the minority dependent on the colonial power, will leaving the colonial power to provide basically minor support as they allow the minority group to do sort of the heavy lifting of imperial subjugation of the majority population. This is why in these areas of majority Shia populations that Sunni-led governments were propped up. This over-exasperated the underlying historical tensions, leading to overt and outright hostility and violence to the sectarian divide. It was the British who revived the militia system in Iraq. These militias were independent of the government, and were sort of puppets of the British. That said, these militias were also the main mechanism for ethnic groups to protect themselves. Iraq was ruled by a royal family until a military coup. Well, to be fair, it was sort of a series of coups that ultimately led to the elevation of the Ba'athist Party, which essentially turned Iraq into a one-party state. It was during the instability of the military leadership coup period that Kuwait gained independence from Britain, something Iraq has rejected from the start. Iraq sees Kuwait as sort of an integral part of its nation. The Ba'athists are, well, were, a largely secular pan-Arab anti-colonial party. Pan-Arabism was a brief movement in the 60s and 70s led by Nasser of Egypt as sort of an attempt to unite all Arab nations in a single confederation. Iraq was one of the pawns used by the Soviets and the Americans in the Cold War. The ties between the Soviet Union were variable. At one point, Iraq was part of COMECON, Council of Mutual Economic Assistance, that was around 1941 to 1991. It was kind of an economic trade union composed of communist Eastern Bloc countries. They received large investments in military support during the early 70s. That said, the Ba'athists also persecuted the Iraqi Communist Party, on and off. But this, as well as increased economic independence thanks to increasing oil revenue, or put another way, less dependence on Soviet investment in arms, made the link between Iraq and the Soviet world tenuous at best. When in 1979 the Shah of Iran, a loyal U.S. ally, was deposed in the Iranian Revolution, well, Saddam took the opportunity sort of to flip sides and became part of the American sphere of influence. The current strife in Iraq region can mainly, in my humble opinion, be traced back to the Iraq-Iran War. Now those who know their history of the region will be asking, which Iraq-Iran War am I referring to? If you look at a map of Iraq, you see that there is a little slip of land that touches the Gulf of Arabia. This is the main route that Iraq has for trading its goods. It's also a major and important thoroughfare for Iran. In modern times, this area, containing the river Arvandrud, has been fought over between Iran and Iraq many times. Well, I say modern times. The Ottomans were fighting over this slip of land as early as the 16th century. As part of this dispute, the province of Khuzestan, or as the Iraqis call it, Arabistan, became part of Iran. This, of course, much to the consternation of Iraq. Also, as part of the dispute, Iran was forced to pay a high toll for the use of the Arvandrud waterways. This led to an ill-fated Iran-Iraq war in 1974, which Iraq lost and was forced to sign a humiliating treaty called Algerian Accord in 1975. Because of this, and with the newfound wealth from oil exports, Saddam, who was now firmly entrenched as the leader of Iraq, resolved that Iraq would never be humiliated again and began a huge military buildup. By 1988, some sources ranked Iraq's army fourth largest in the world. When the Shah of Iran was toppled, and there was much chaos in Iran, Saddam believed he saw an opportunity to right historical wrongs and attack Iran. It was also largely believed that such an attack was strongly supported by the Americans as a way of sort of getting back at Iran for the hostage situation. This led to the Iran-Iraq War of 1980, which lasted until 1988, where both sides basically gave up in exhaustion. This war, beyond a death toll in the millions, was also notable because it was the first major conflict that saw the return of chemical weapons used by Iraq against the Iranians. Now, the weapons were not provided by the U.S. government directly. In fact, most of the material for them came from European businesses. That said, the U.S. knew that Saddam was using them, that this was a violation of international law and warranted the designation of a war crime. They were complacent as well because the chemical weapons would not have been made available to Iraq without U.S. covert, if not overt, consent. Beyond that, the Reagan administration provided logistical and targeting information to help the Iraqi war effort, full in the knowledge that such info was being used to direct chemical weapon attacks. I think, if we return to our original question, the U.S. did not supply Iraq with weapons of mass destruction, of which chemical weapons qualify, but they did approve of their supply and actively helped in their use. So although not technically true, it is true. Now, a side effect of this war was the destruction of the Iraqi economy, because one thing the Iranians managed to do was to decimate Iraq's ability to export oil. Couple that with a drop in oil prices, Iraq was saddled with a huge debt, about $80 billion. Because Saddam thought that he was not only battling to promote Iraqi territorial efforts, but was also fighting to help the Sunni Arab nations, that by defeating or at least weakening the Shiite Iran, a nation actively trying to promote revolution in nations like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, that they were defending all Sunni nations. Saddam seemed to believe that his nation would supply the manpower, while other nations would help finance the war. I mentioned Kuwait because a large part of Iraq's debt was held by Kuwait. Saddam expected Kuwait to forgive that debt as Kuwait's contribution to the, what I shall call the Sunni-Shiite War. Oddly, Kuwait did not see things this way. This led Iraq, from its perspective, reclaiming its wayward province of Kuwait by invading in 1990. Now, this invasion was not a surprise, as Iraq was making signals that if Kuwait did not forgive its debt, it would invade. To this end, the U.S. government stated it would take a neutral stance on the situation, and more specifically, the American ambassador declared to the Iraqi interlocutor that, quote, Washington, inspired by friendship and not by confrontation, does not have an opinion on the disagreement between Kuwait and Iraq, stating that we have no opinion on Arab-Arab conflicts. The ambassador also let Saddam Hussein know that the United States did not intend to start an economic war against Iraq. Thus, I am sure Saddam was quite surprised when Bush Sr. rallied a coalition and started the first Gulf War. Part of the reason for this U.S. action was one of the greatest examples of propaganda ever, where you have a congressional committee hearing about the atrocities that the Iraqi army was doing. Let's listen in.
Thank you very much. Our final witness is also using an assumed name, and again, we ask our friends in the media to respect the need to for her to protect her family. And we finally call on Naira to testify.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Naira, and I just came out of Kuwait. My mother and I were in Kuwait on August 2nd for a peaceful summer holiday. My older sister had a baby on July 29th, and we wanted to spend some time in Kuwait with her. I only pray that none of my 10th grade classmates had a summer vacation like I did. I may have wished sometime that I could be an adult, that I could grow up quickly. What I saw happen to the children of Kuwait and to my country has changed my life forever. It has changed the life of all Kuwaitis, young and old. We are children no more. My sister, with my five-day-old nephew, traveled across the desert to safety. There was no milk available for the baby in Kuwait. They barely escaped when their car was stuck in the desert sand, and help came from Saudi Arabia. I stayed behind and wanted to do something for my country. The second week after an invasion, I volunteered at the Al-Adan Hospital with 12 other women who wanted to help as well. I was the youngest volunteer. The other women were from 20 to 30 years old. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
Now, that does sound horrific. An unbelievable act of brutality. And actually, it kind of was unbelievable. In fact, the innocent girl testifying was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador, who was nowhere near Kuwait during or after the invasion. The incident related was complete fiction, but it did play its part in pushing the U.S. into war. So after the shellacking the Iraq army took in the Gulf War and the international sanctions, well, Iraq, which was one of the more well-developed parts of the Arab nation, was quickly digressing into sort of a Stone Age state. This situation was exacerbated as the U.S. tried to destabilize the Saddam regime by helping Islamic extremists. These groups saw Saddam as too secular, which he was. Although during the 90s, in an effort to sort of help prop up his regime and gain sympathy in the Arab world, he did start wrapping himself more and more as a defender of the faith against the evil imperialist American Western powers. There was a growing use of religious imagery in Iraq to prove its religious bona fides, in spite of the fact that the Baathists were still largely a secular party. Now, the lead up to the Second Gulf War saw a lot of weird things happen. So first, did Iraq have weapons of mass destruction? Well, yes, as in that there was likely some leftover stock of chemical weapons from the Iran-Iraq War, although most of this was well past its best before date. There was also a long-standing belief that Saddam was trying to produce chemical, biological, and or nuclear weapons. The UN had inspectors in Iraq since the first Gulf War. These inspectors did uncover attempts by Iraq, at least early on, of trying to produce biological and chemical weapons, efforts that had been abandoned and were never really a threat. In fact, the chief inspector of the UN, Scott Ritter, a former U.S. military advisor and Fox News contributor, hardly a softie on this issue, stated that,
"When you ask the question, does Iraq pose military viable biological or chemical weapons? The answer is no, and a resounding no. Can Iraq produce today chemical weapons on a meaningful scale? No. Can Iraq produce biological weapons on a meaningful scale? No. Ballistic missiles? No. It is no across the board. So from a qualitative standpoint, Iraq has been disarmed. Iraq today possesses no meaningful weapons of mass destruction capability."
Okay, that said, Saddam, as sort of a point of principle and as a sort of negotiating tool to try and lift sanctions, didn't make the UN's job easy. That said, 98% of all inspection activity occurred with complete Iraqi cooperation. And the Iraqi officials claimed the resistance only occurred when inspections involved the security procedures around Saddam Hussein, a target by the CIA. It was also an open secret that the U.S. spies were members of the inspection teams. It was this supposed refusal to allow inspections, which was not completely true, that became the casus belli of the war, at first anyway. It is funny, in the U.S. legislation authorizing military action, the only references to weapons of mass destruction was with regards to Saddam's willingness to use them on his own people, and not that Iraq was any sort of threat to the U.S. security. If you were in a crowd at the Republican convention in 2004, you would have noticed that every time 9/11 was mentioned, you would have also heard Saddam or Iraq mentioned. There is a willful effort to conflate the two. To this day, 60% of Americans think that Saddam was somehow responsible for 9/11. When pressed, the official line was Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. But the conflation of the two continued, along with the attempts to connect Saddam with global terrorism in general. This was also discredited by academics that point out that one of the major threats to Saddam's regime was fundamentalist Islam, as that was a force actively trying to overthrow the Baathist regime. Now, it is true that Saddam supported the Palestinian cause, and this included paying a sort of life insurance for Palestinian suicide bombers. But this had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, which was a constant innuendo of the Bush administration. There is, of course, the famous Yellow Cake speech made by Colin Powell to the UN, where he claimed that there was undeniable evidence that Saddam was trying to acquire Yellow Cake. That's the natural occurring form of uranium, from which weapon-grade uranium could be extracted. It was known prior to his testimony, at least in the intelligence community and the alternative media who reported on this, well, that the Yellow Cake story was a complete fabrication, a pure fiction. There was also claims that Saddam had portable biological weapons factories and other evidence of his attempts to procure weapons of mass destruction, with Condoleezza Rice summing it up, saying that we don't want the evidence being a mushroom cloud. As it turned out, there are no weapons of mass destruction, and that the administration largely knew that this was the case, that they actively attempted to persuade Americans that the only thing that can be done, that the U.S. must attack and remove Saddam from Iraq before he destroys the U.S. Was this a conspiracy? Likely. That said, a lot of blame was laid at the feet of confirmation bias and wishful thinking, that any statement made by a supposed witness was assumed true if it supported the let's invade argument. We can remember the infamous informant, Curveball, what an appropriate code name, that this source just made shit up. Once it became clear that there were no weapons of mass destruction, the Bush administration changed their justification for the war by claiming it was a humanitarian and that the goal was to liberate Iraq. Now, I and many others have implied that there was a conspiracy to invade Iraq. Why would Bush wish to do this? Well, some say it was personal, that Saddam apparently sponsored a failed assassination attempt on Bush Sr. in the 90s. Maybe. But why would the rest of the government go along on such a personal vendetta? Iraq does have the world's fifth largest proven oil reserves, so some claim that the real aim was to secure Iraqi oil for Exxon and the like. Well, that may be true, and the American government is largely under the control of corporate interests. The ties between the oil giant Halliburton and then Vice President Dick Cheney make this opinion, if not absolutely true, it does seem that it was highly influential in the decision-making. My own conspiracy theory is the military-industrial complex was the driving force behind the Iraq War. That is, war is very profitable. The cost of one cruise missile is $1 to $2 million. And after 9/11, the Afghan War, U.S. corporations quickly realized that this was one issue that the U.S. government was willing to spend an unlimited amount of money with nominal oversight. By nominal oversight, I mean that they were throwing money at projects irrespective of that project's likelihood of success. A great example of this is the homeopathic bomb detector the U.S. and the Iraqi government, with U.S. money, bought. A detector that was a reworked novelty golf ball detector. And by novelty, I mean like the x-ray glasses you find in the back of comic books. Halliburton, now called KBR, was paid almost $40 billion to maintain a U.S. military base in Iraq. A job it's done so shoddily that it has earned universal criticism from everyone, including the military. Let's not forget the $6 billion that just got lost in Baghdad, just went poof. And as well, let us not forget, it is thanks to the Afghan and Iraq wars that the entire drone industry came into its own. Whether the U.S. was lied into war or not, that's unimportant. The U.S. invaded. But unlike the first Gulf War, where almost a million troops were used, this second war was executed under the Rumsfeld Doctrine. The Rumsfeld Doctrine relied heavily on U.S. technical superiority. Thus, the Second Gulf War saw a U.S. invasion force of less than 150,000 troops, a combined coalition force only numbered about 200,000. That number increases to about 300,000 if you include, like, the Kurdish insurgents and the like. Rumsfeld gambled, and successfully, that if the U.S. used its shock and awe factor, its overwhelming technical superiority, it could quickly defeat the Iraqi military. And he was right. The war was over in 21 days. What Rumsfeld seems to have failed to take into consideration is the occupation of Iraq, which officially lasted almost 9 years. But if U.S. forces are drawn back into Iraq, as seems likely over the ISIS affair, well, that tale seems still to be continuing. But the trouble occupying with such a small force has become obvious. Iraq is small by Canadian standards, but it's still a large nation, larger than Texas and California combined, and a population greater than that of Canada. There are just not enough soldiers to control Iraq. You might say, well, there was still the police and the like. Even if Saddam was gone, the government still persisted. Well, no. In another self-defeating act, the first thing the U.S. did was to de-bathify Iraq. This meant that anyone who was a member of the Ba'ath Party was essentially fired. This meant that pretty much all of the military, civil servants, the government in general was gone. Not only gone, but forbidden to ever participate in government and military education again. Remember, this was a one-party state controlled by a brutal dictator. Everyone, whether you wanted to be or not, was a member of the party. This essentially put Iraq into a lawless state. This is when you have the rise of the militias. The militias, based on ethnic, tribal, or sectarian ties, stepped into the vacuum created by the American sanctions. If we remember, militias have a long history in Iraq. This, of course, meant that minor historical divides emerged, that slights by one group were met by sort of an eye for an eye type of justice. Of course, the U.S. oversaw the reconstruction of the Iraq government, but again, thanks to the de-Ba'athification and the fact that the Shiite majority were historically against the now defunct Saddam regime, Well, the Iraqi government, the Iraqi military, the Iraqi security forces were really the Shiite government, military, etc. This is one of the reasons that the major divides in Iraq are along sectarian lines, mainly Shiite-Sunni. But as we are seeing with ISIS, internal divides between sects of Sunniism and Shiitism are creating the borders of this divided former nation. We're still too close to the time of the war to know for sure how history will judge this debacle. That said, the current rise of ISIS, the civil war in Syria, the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank, the general rise of radical Islam can largely be seen as at least being amplified, if not instigated, by the U.S. policy to Iraq. Oh yes, and one final note. Were people really upset about Bush's lying to the about the Iraq war versus Bill Clinton's blowjob? Well, it depends on who you were listening to. If you were listening to the mainstream media, yes, there was a huge difference. It seems like Bill Clinton was definitely vilified and seen as a very bad person. And Bush, well, Bush, I guess the worst that he seemed to get in the mainstream media was he was either ill-advised or controlled by evil Cheney or wasn't just smart enough to know better. That being said, if you were listening to the alternative media, things like Democracy Now!, the Real News Network, and of course, Radio Free Thinker, those places were sitting there saying, hey, this is the truth, you're being lied to. Why are you doing this? And we may not remember this, but in the lead up to the Iraq War, we saw some of the largest protests against the war, numbering well over millions of people in all the major Western centers in the world. And yet, the war went on, and again, that plays more into my own military-industrial complex, the U.S. government owned by corporations, quasi-conspiracy theory. But I think that's all for this particular topic. We'll be back with a bit of web wisdom after this.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
We're back. So we got some web wisdom. This is Glenn Greenwald, who is one of the first reporters to see and write about the Edward Snowden files, with the revelations about USA's extensive surveillance of private citizens. In this talk, Greenwald makes the case for why we need to take care about our privacy, even if you're, quote, not doing anything you need to hide. So let's listen.
There is an entire genre of YouTube videos devoted to an experience which I am certain that everyone in this room has had. It entails an individual who, thinking they're alone, engages in some expressive behavior, wild singing, gyrating dancing, some mild sexual activity, only to discover that, in fact, they are not alone, that there is a person watching and lurking, the discovery of which causes them to immediately cease what they're doing in horror. The sense of shame and humiliation in their face is palpable. It's the sense of, this is something I'm willing to do only if no one else is watching. This is the crux of the work on which I have been singularly focused for the last 16 months, the question of why privacy matters, a question that has arisen in the context of a global debate enabled by the revelations of Edward Snowden that the United States and its partners, unbeknownst to the entire world, has converted the internet, once heralded as an unprecedented tool of liberation and democratization, into an unprecedented zone of mass indiscriminate surveillance. There is a very common sentiment that arises in this debate, even among people who are uncomfortable with mass surveillance, which says that there's no real harm that comes from this large-scale invasion because only people who are engaged in bad acts have a reason to want to hide and to care about their privacy. This worldview is implicitly grounded in the proposition that there are two kinds of people in the world, good people and bad people. Bad people are those who plot terrorist attacks or who engage in violent criminality and therefore have reasons to want to hide what they're doing, have reasons to care about their privacy. But by contrast, good people are people who go to work, come home, raise their children, watch television. They use the internet not to plot bombing attacks, but to read the news or exchange recipes or to plan their kids' Little League games. And those people are doing nothing wrong and therefore have nothing to hide and no reason to fear the government monitoring them. The people who are actually saying that are engaged in a very extreme act of self-deprecation. What they're really saying is, I have agreed to make myself such a harmless and unthreatening and uninteresting person that I actually don't fear having the government know what it is that I'm doing. This mindset has found what I think is its purest expression in a 2009 interview with the longtime CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, who, when asked about all the different ways his company is causing invasions of privacy for hundreds of millions of people around the world, said this. He said, if you're doing something that you don't want other people to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. Now, there's all kinds of things to say about that mentality. The first of which is that the people who say that privacy isn't really important, they don't actually believe it. And the way you know that they don't actually believe it is that while they say with their words that privacy doesn't matter, with their actions, they take all kinds of steps to safeguard their privacy. They put passwords on their email and their social media accounts. They put locks on their bedroom and bathroom doors, all steps designed to prevent other people from entering what they consider their private realm and knowing what it is that they don't want other people to know. The very same Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, ordered his employees at Google to cease speaking with the online internet magazine CNET, after CNET published an article full of personal private information about Eric Schmidt, which it obtained exclusively through Google searches and using other Google products. This same division can be seen with the CEO of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, who in an infamous interview in 2010 pronounced that privacy is no longer a, quote, social norm. Last year, Mark Zuckerberg and his new wife purchased not only their own house, but also all four adjacent houses in Palo Alto for a total of $30 million in order to ensure that they enjoyed a zone of privacy that prevented other people from monitoring what they do in their personal lives. Over the last 16 months, as I've debated this issue around the world, every single time somebody has said to me, I don't really worry about invasions of privacy because I don't have anything to hide, I always say the same thing to them. I get out a pen, I write down my email address, I say, here's my email address. What I want you to do when you get home is email me the passwords to all of your email accounts. Not just the nice, respectable work one in your name, but all of them. Because I want to be able to just troll through what it is you're doing online, read what I want to read, and publish whatever I find interesting. After all, if you're not a bad person, if you're doing nothing wrong, you should have nothing to hide. Not a single person has taken me up on that offer. I check that email account religiously all the time. It's a very desolate place. And there's a reason for that, which is that we as human beings, even those of us who in words disclaim the importance of our own privacy, instinctively understand the profound importance of it. It is true that as human beings, we're social animals, which means we have a need for other people to know what we're doing and saying and thinking, which is why we voluntarily publish information about ourselves online. But equally essential to what it means to be a free and fulfilled human being is to have a place that we can go and be free of the judgmental eyes of other people. There's a reason why we seek that out, and that reason is that all of us, not just terrorists and criminals, all of us have things to hide. There are all sorts of things that we do and think that we're willing to tell our physician or our lawyer or our psychologist or our spouse or our best friend that we would be mortified for the rest of the world to learn. We make judgments every single day about the kinds of things that we say and think and do that we're willing to have other people know, and the kinds of things that we say and think and do that we don't want anyone else to know about. People can very easily, in words, claim that they don't value their privacy, but their actions negate the authenticity of that belief. Now, there's a reason why privacy is so craved universally and instinctively. It isn't just a reflexive movement like breathing air or drinking water. The reason is that when we're in a state where we can be monitored, where we can be watched, our behavior changes dramatically. The range of behavioral options that we consider when we think we're being watched severely reduce. This is just a fact of human nature that has been recognized in social science and in literature and in religion and in virtually every field of discipline. There are dozens of psychological studies that prove that when somebody knows that they might be watched, the behavior they engage in is vastly more conformist and compliant. Human shame is a very powerful motivator, as is the desire to avoid it. And that's the reason why people, when they're in a state of being watched, make decisions not that are the byproduct of their own agency, but that are about the expectations that others have of them or the mandates of societal orthodoxy. This realization was exploited most powerfully for pragmatic ends by the 18th century philosopher Jeremy Bentham, who set out to resolve an important problem ushered in by the Industrial Age, where for the first time institutions had become so large and centralized that they were no longer able to monitor and therefore control each one of their individual members. And the solution that he devised was an architectural design originally intended to be implemented in prisons that he called the Panopticon, the primary attribute of which was the construction of an enormous tower in the center of the institution, where whoever controlled the institution could at any moment watch any of the inmates, although they couldn't watch all of them at all times. And crucial to this design was that the inmates could not actually see into the panopticon, into the tower, and so they never knew if they were being watched or even when. And what made him so excited about this discovery was that that would mean that the prisoners would have to assume that they were being watched at any given moment, which would be the ultimate enforcer for obedience and compliance. The 20th century French philosopher Michel Foucault realized that that model could be used not just for prisons, but for every institution that seeks to control human behavior: schools, hospitals, factories, workplaces. And what he said was that this mindset, this framework discovered by Bentham, was the key means of societal control for modern Western societies, which no longer need the overt weapons of tyranny, punishing or imprisoning or killing dissidents, or legally compelling loyalty to a particular party, because mass surveillance creates a prison in the mind that is a much more subtle, though much more effective means of fostering compliance with social norms or with social orthodoxy, much more effective than brute force could ever be. The most iconic work of literature about surveillance and privacy is the George Orwell novel 1984, which we all learn in school, and therefore it's almost become a cliche. In fact, whenever you bring it up in a debate about surveillance, people instantaneously dismiss it as inapplicable. And what they say is, oh, well, in 1984, there were monitors in people's homes, they were being watched at every given moment, and that has nothing to do with the surveillance state that we face. That is an actual fundamental misapprehension of the warnings that Orwell issued in 1984. The warning that he was issuing was about a surveillance state, not that monitored everybody at all times, but where people were aware that they could be monitored at any given moment. Here is how Orwell's narrator, Winston Smith, described the surveillance system that they faced. Quote, "There was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment." He went on to say, "At any rate, they could plug in your wire whenever they wanted to. You had to live, did live, from habit that became instinct, in the assumption that every sound you made was overheard, and except in darkness, every movement scrutinized." The Abrahamic religions similarly posit that there's an invisible, all-knowing authority who, because of its omniscience, always watches whatever you're doing, which means you never have a private moment, the ultimate enforcer for obedience to its dictates. What all of these seemingly disparate works recognize, the conclusion that they all reach, is that a society in which people can be monitored at all times is a society that breeds conformity and obedience and submission, which is why every tyrant, the most overt to the most subtle, craves that system. Conversely, even more importantly, it is a realm of privacy, the ability to go somewhere where we can think and reason and interact and speak without the judgmental eyes of others being cast upon us, in which creativity and exploration and dissent exclusively reside. And that is the reason why, when we allow a society to exist in which we're subject to constant monitoring, we allow the essence of human freedom to be severely crippled. The last point I want to observe about this mindset, the idea that only people who are doing nothing wrong have things to hide and therefore reasons to care about privacy, is that it entrenches two very destructive messages, two destructive lessons. The first of which is that the only people who care about privacy, the only people who will seek out privacy, are by definition bad people. This is a conclusion that we should have all kinds of reasons for avoiding. The most important of which is that when you say somebody who's doing bad things, you probably mean things like plotting a terrorist attack or engaging in violent criminality, a much narrower conception of what people who wield power mean when they say doing bad things. For them, doing bad things typically means doing something that poses meaningful challenges to the exercise of our own power. The other really destructive and I think even more insidious lesson that comes from accepting this mindset is there's an implicit bargain that people who accept this mindset have accepted. And that bargain is this: if you're willing to render yourself sufficiently harmless, sufficiently unthreatening to those who wield political power, then and only then can you be free of the dangers of surveillance. It's only those who are dissidents, who challenge power, who have something to worry about. There are all kinds of reasons why we should want to avoid that lesson as well. You may be a person who right now doesn't want to engage in that behavior, but at some point in the future you might. Even if you're somebody who decides you never want to, the fact that there are other people who are willing to and able to resist and be adversarial to those in power, dissidents and journalists and activists and a whole range of others, is something that brings us all collective good that we should want to preserve. Equally critical is that the measure of how free a society is not how it treats its good, obedient, compliant citizens, but how it treats its dissidents and those who resist orthodoxy. But the most important reason is that a system of mass surveillance suppresses our own freedom in all sorts of ways. It renders off limits all kinds of behavioral choices without our even knowing that it's happened. The renowned socialist activist Rosa Luxemburg once said, "He who does not move does not notice his chains." We can try and render the chains of mass surveillance invisible or undetectable, but the constraints that it imposes on us do not become any less potent. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Glenn, thank you. The case is rather convincing, I have to say, but I want to bring you back to the last 6 months and to Edward Snowden for a few questions, if you don't mind. And the first one is personal to you. Is we have all read about the arrest of your partner, David Miranda, in London and other difficulties, but I assume that in terms of personal engagement and risk and the pressure on you is not that easy to take on the biggest surveillance organizations in the world. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I think one of the things that happens is that people's courage in this regard gets contagious. And so although I and the other journalists with whom I was working were certainly aware of the risk, the United States continues to be the most powerful country in the world and doesn't appreciate it when you disclose thousands of their secrets on the internet at will. Seeing somebody who's a 29-year-old ordinary person who grew up in very ordinary environment exercise the degree of principled courage that Edward Snowden risked, knowing that he was going to go to prison for the rest of his life or that his life would unravel, inspired me. It inspired other journalists. It inspired, I think, people around the world, including future whistleblowers, to realize that they can engage in that kind of behavior as well.
I'm curious about your relationship with Ed Snowden, because you have spoken with him a lot, and you certainly continue doing so. But in your book, you never call him Edward, nor Ed. You say Snowden. How so?
You know, I'm sure that's something for a team of psychologists to examine. I don't really know the reason. I think that, you know, one of the important objectives that he actually had, one of his, I think, most important tactics, was that he knew that one of the ways to distract attention from the substance of the revelations would be to try and personalize the focus on him. And for that reason, he stayed out of the media. He tried not to ever have his personal life subject to examination. And so I think calling him Snowden is a way of just identifying him as this important historical actor rather than trying to personalize him in a way that might distract attention from the substance.
So his revelation, your analysis, the work of other journalists have really developed the debate. And many governments, for example, have reacted, including in Brazil, with projects and programs to reshape a little bit the design of the internet, etc. There are a lot of things going on in that sense. But I'm wondering, for you personally, what is the end game? At what point you will think, well, actually, we succeeded in moving the dial?
Well, I mean, the end game for me as a journalist is very simple, which is to make sure that every single document that's newsworthy and that ought to be disclosed ends up being disclosed, and that secrets that should never have been kept in the first place end up uncovered. To me, that's the essence of journalism, and that's what I'm committed to doing. As somebody who finds mass surveillance odious for all the reasons I just talked about and a lot more, I mean, I look at this as work that will never end until governments around the world are no longer able to subject entire populations to monitoring and surveillance unless they convince some court or some entity that the person they've targeted has actually done something wrong. To me, that's the way that privacy can be rejuvenated.
So Snowden is very, as we've seen of Ted, is very articulate in presenting and portraying himself as a defender of democratic values and democratic principles. But then many people really find it difficult to believe that those were his only motivations. They find it difficult to believe that there was no money involved, that he didn't sell some of those secrets even to China and to Russia, which are clearly not the best friends of the United States right now. And I'm sure many people in the room are wondering the same question. Do you consider it possible there is that part of Snowden we were not seeing yet?
No, I consider that absurd and idiotic. If you wanted to, and I know you're just playing devil's advocate, but if you wanted to sell secrets to another country, which he could have done and become extremely rich doing so, the last thing you would do is take those secrets and give them to journalists and ask journalists to publish them, because it makes those secrets worthless. People who want to enrich themselves do it secretly by selling secrets to the government. But I think there's one important point worth making, which is that accusation comes from people in the U.S. government, from people in the media who are loyalists to these various governments. And I think a lot of times when people make accusations like that about other people, oh, he can't really be doing this for principled reasons, he must have some corrupt, nefarious reason, they're saying a lot more about themselves than they are the target of their accusations, because those people, the ones who make that accusation, they themselves never act for any reason other than corrupt reasons. So they assume that everybody else is plagued by the same disease of soullessness as they are. So that's the assumption.
Glenn, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Greenwald.
I appreciate it.
So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on. And what's your privacy?
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch.
You really want to know what love is?
Yeah. Yes, tell us. More than anything in the world, Ron.
Well, it's really quite simple. It's kind of like... Gonna find my baby, gonna hold her tight, gonna grab some afternoon delight. My motto's always been, when it's right, why wait until the middle of a cold, dark night? When everything's a little clearer in the light of day, and we know the night is always gonna be here anyway. Thinking of you's working up my appetite, looking forward to a little afternoon.